Joshua chapter 4, which is the continuation of the story of Israel crossing the Jordan River into the Promised Land. It is very unfortunate that we had to stop at chapter 3 2 weeks ago and split up chapter 3 and chapter 4 because they both really do tell one full story. I think it was me, I wouldn't have even put a chapter division here. If you read chapter 3, verse 17, and then chapter 4, verse 1, really there's no good place for a chapter break there. It's incomplete without chapter 4. So whether you realize it or not, we kind of left things hanging at the end of chapter 3. Now I realize when we read verse 16, verse 17, and when you look at chapter 4, verse 1, that we find all of the people of Israel on the west side of the Jordan River actually in the Promised Land, but that is just the people. The fact is that the priests, as of where we are in the story, the priests are still standing out there in the riverbed of the Jordan. We've left them out there for 2 weeks. And thankfully, the Lord didn't leave them out there quite that long. But we get back to it. We pick up the story there. That's where we are in the progression of the story. But before Joshua finally releases the priest to finish that crossing over of the Jordan riverbed and into the Promised Land, the Lord is first going to speak to Joshua, and he's going to command Joshua to send runners back and forth. They have crossed over. He's going to send guys back in to the riverbed, the dry riverbed of the Jordan, on a special mission from the Lord, and it is one that should speak volumes into your heart tonight, if you will open your heart to the message and let it do so. So let's begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 4. When all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, and again, that would be just referring to the people, the Lord said to Joshua, with the priest still out there in the middle of the Jordan riverbed with the Ark of the Covenant, verse 2, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, verse 3, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from here, out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you, and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight. And we're going to find out in verse 19 that that place would be Gilgal. That's where the Lord is taking them to. That's their first camp spot inside the Promised Land. Gilgal was about 8 miles slightly north of where they would have been crossing over here. So it is a substantial distance just to walk if you're not carrying heavy rocks, and all the more challenging if you're carrying large rocks for 8 miles. It's quite a hike. This is one of those things that you probably would not get a whole lot of volunteers for. And maybe that's why the Lord said, instead of accept applications or open this up to volunteers, I mean, can you just imagine their post on their church website, you know, accepting volunteer positions for men to carry large rocks over large distances? Probably not exactly going to tie up the phone lines for the church that week. So it's no wonder that the Lord told Joshua to actually pick men, 12 men, one from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. Very symbolic thing here. We read in verse 4, then Joshua called the 12 men from the people of Israel whom he had appointed. Notice they did not, in fact, volunteer. He picked them, a man from each tribe, verse 5. And Joshua said to them, pass on before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan. So in other words, they had already crossed over at this point. They're now on the west side of the Jordan, the Promised Land side of the Jordan River. And Joshua is sending them to go back to near where the ark was located. And he says, take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder. And I think that sort of communicates the Lord's intention here about the size of these rocks that they were to bring back. They were big enough that you couldn't carry them with just your hands, but they were manageable enough that you could carry them on your shoulder. So they weren't to show up with 12 pieces of gravel. I mean, I think Joshua had to say, guys, please, I mean, you know, I'm not telling you to break your back here, But don't come back with a little handheld rock. It's not going to serve the purpose. The Lord is aiming for something big here. As I think we could safely say, the Lord always is. He's always aiming for something big. If you're trying to do something with the Lord and you're trying to decide between the small thing and the big thing, I don't know. I say just go for the big thing, because I think that's the way the Lord usually works. So each one of you taking a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, that'd be 12, verse 6, that this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? Verse 7, then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord when it passed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off, so these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. And I want to point out, this is Joshua getting this information. So we're going to read about this stuff again. It sounds like we're reading it twice. Really, we're seeing it come from God to Joshua, and then we're going to read about Joshua relaying all of these words along to the people. There are so many practical truths that can be found in studying this chapter. One of the first ones that really leaps off of the pages at me is from verse 7. The waters of the Jordan were not cut off before the people. They were not cut off before their leader Joshua. They weren't even cut off before the priest, the holy priest. But the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant. That was an important piece to what the Lord was doing here. If they decided to leave the Ark of the Covenant east of the Jordan River, then they would be gurgling water. They would never have made it. It was actually God's ark that he was protecting by cutting off the waters of the Jordan River. That was the centerpiece for this miracle that the Lord was doing. Again, we know the ark symbolizes God's presence, his fellowship with mankind. So it is that symbolism in all of this that God is seeking to preserve. And that speaks volumes to me about my life in Christ. It tells me that the safest and most protected place for me to be is in the midst of whatever it is that God is involved and invested in. Because whatever he is involved and invested in, he will protect. And there's no way to destroy whatever the Lord is involved or invested in. So when I get myself aligned with those same motivations and work intentions that the Lord has, then I am aligning myself in a safe place, and I can guarantee that my life is well invested, that my foundation is quite solid. But on to the main point here of the first seven verses of this chapter. Look at verse 6 for a moment. And notice it does not say, if your children ask. It says, when your children ask. They're definitely going to ask. You know, this would be a pyramid of rocks is the way I figure it. You got 12 of them. They're large. And you got to stack them. You got to make a monument out of them. So I don't know. If they were really talented, maybe they could do one of those straight up things. But I don't figure that lasts very long. Not with kids. So I figure this is more like a pyramid shape. You know, throw 6 rocks for the base, 4 in the next layer, couple in the top layer, that sort of thing. And when kids see something like that, they're fairly intelligent beings, even at young ages, and they'll recognize that's a human accomplished thing. That's not something that is naturally occurring in nature. You don't just walk through the woods and see that and think, wow, you know, great landscape. You recognize something like that as a man-made thing. And so kids are going to ask about that. If nothing else, well, they're probably going to ask if they can climb it or if they can play on it, because kids are going to be kids. By the way, this command is given specifically to the fathers. We don't see that specified on the first occasion here, but if you look at verse 21, you'll see the specification. This is aimed at the fathers. It's the Lord telling the fathers, I'm setting up this memorial, and your kids are going to ask about it. Dad, what's this about? And it's your responsibility, fathers, to make sure that you take that opportunity to instruct your kids and tell them what this monument means. So suffice it to say, I won't make a big deal about it, but suffice it to say, fathers, as the spiritual leaders in their homes, have the primary responsibility of guiding their families, their homes, their children, in the love and in the fear of the Lord. Now, that does not minimize the mother's role in that. It does not take away from the single mom or anything of the sort. But what it does is it tells us that according to the Lord, that's where the buck stops for him. That the man, as the head of the home, it's his ultimate responsibility to make sure that this is getting done and that it's getting done effectively. What am I speaking about? Instructing your children about the Lord, teaching them faith and developing their faith in God. Now, this includes the command for instruction that we're reading about in chapter 4, that God is instructing parents to use the natural inquisitiveness of children as opportunities to teach those children about the Lord and faith in Him. Because we all know that children are little question factories. I don't even know where they come from. It's incredible. And some parents, especially dads, get frustrated with the million questions, especially when it's been a long, hard day, and all that dad wants to do is find some alone, quiet time on the recliner. But that the responsibility is still there. And the responsibility is not always going to be convenient, but it's still a responsibility, and it is still a command of God. I'll never forget my cousin Mark when he was somewhere around 8 years old. I think I was probably 16 or 17 years old at the time. And my goodness, could that kid ask a lot of questions. I have never seen anything like that, even to this day. I've never seen a child, a human being, I've never seen someone ask as many consecutive questions as he would. And at the time, we were in transition. We were selling our place on Atlantic Avenue there in Uniontown, and we were moving to a lovely spot in Smock that we named Canaan Valley. And at the in-between process there, we were staying in a place right next to where little Mark was living. So he was down there all day, just question after question until my ears bled. And I honestly, I can remember hearing the knock on the door and peeking through the window and seeing that it was him and turning off the lights and quietly hiding, hoping that he would just go away. Am I proud of that? Actually, yeah, I am, because it's not my kid. It's not my kid. He had parents to answer his trillion questions. I wasn't his parent. I wasn't even an adult, so I'm fine with it. Well, I guess I said all that to reinforce my point that the inquisitive mind of a child, and I know it can be a nuisance when it's someone else's child, but just hear my point here. The inquisitive mind of a child, your child, is a blessing and not a curse. It's God-given so that parents don't get lazy in the process and fail to train their children. Their children are just naturally going to ask these questions, and every question is an opportunity if you'll seize it. I know the temptation is to give the quick answer just to get the kid to shut up and go away. You guys don't know what I'm talking about yet. Give it a few years. The temptation is to give those simple, not so deep, kind of surface answers. Things like this, well, it's just what we've always done, you know. It's tradition. Tradition. Sorry, me and Maggie just watched Fiddler on the Roof again. If you'll seize those opportunities, if you'll take the time to take advantage of that at a very young age, you can begin to develop faith in those children. How did Israel do with this? Well, you can read it for yourself if you want to turn with me. This is the book of Judges, the next book in the Bible, Judges chapter 2. I'm going to read verses 8 through 10 for you. Here's how Israel did with it. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years, and they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gaash. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And isn't that amazing? How well did they do? They did terrible. They didn't even get the message to the next generation. They didn't even train their children. They didn't even say, this is what the rock pile is about. This is a memorial of the miracle that God did to bring us here, to give us this land that he had promised to us. So they did a terrible job, but be careful, parents. And don't criticize second generation of Israel for not conveying that to third generation Israel if you're not yourself doing better than they with your own children. You know, dad, mom, why do we go to church? Well, grandma and grandpa always did. So we do. Dad, mom, why do we do communion? Tradition. You know, if we're not answering those questions in ways that cultivate their faith, then we're doing no better than the second generation of Israel. Verse 8. And the people of Israel did just as Joshua commanded and took up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, just as the Lord told Joshua, and they carried them over with them to the place where they lodged and laid them down there. Verse 9. And Joshua set up 12 stones. This is new. Listen very carefully to this. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood, and they are there to this day. In other words, they were there still in place at the time of Joshua writing this chapter. But did you catch the big news of verse 9, the new thing that we haven't read about yet? They have actually got two monuments now. We knew about the one. God told them to take 12 stones from the midst of the riverbed of the Jordan, right near where the priests were standing, gather 12 large stones from there, bring them over across on the promised land side of the Jordan, and stack them. But we just read in verse 9 that what Joshua also did, and probably at the command of the Lord, perhaps not, perhaps it was just a wonderful idea he had. Either way, it was a wonderful idea. Joshua didn't just have that done, but what he also did, and, you know, these poor 12 guys, if they agreed to one trip, well, it ended up being two, because once they get the rocks over there on the Jordan side, or pardon me, the east side of the Jordan in the promised land, they're now going and taking rocks, I would assume, from the land side, and they're taking those into the riverbed, and they're putting them right near, making a monument where the Ark of the Covenant stood. So you have two monuments now. You have a public memorial, and you have a private memorial. You have a monument that could be seen by the whole world, and you now have a monument that could only be known about by those who put it there. And of course, maybe some scuba divers in the future, but the technology wasn't there yet. So you've got these two monuments, one public and one private. You can call that a pattern. You can call it a principle for spiritual life, but either way, whichever one you prefer, I think that we do learn something beneficial from this as Christians, that it's a good thing for us to have both of these kind of memorials in our lives. First of all, the kind of memorial that is public, the kind of memorial that we want to broadcast to the whole world. And I would think, you know, communion, in my opinion, falls under that kind of thing. It's a memorial of what Christ has done for us in dying for our sins. And don't we want the whole world to know about that? I mean, would you be happy if people were tuning in on the live stream, all across the country and watching you take communion, watching you memorialize what Christ has done for you in that? Well, you got other public things that serve as memorials. Your testimony, your public testimony. It could be anything that you wish to make public before the world to show them what God has done in your life. For some, that might be a vision that the Lord gave you. I think of Drumhiller here. Is that his name, Drumhiller? You remember him? Lord gave him a vision. It's all he wants to talk about. Well, it's a public memorial in his life that he wants the whole world to know. Those are wonderful, whatever they may be for us. But I think it's also extremely healthy for us to have private ones as well. Internal memorials that are personal to us. They're based on personal miracles that the Lord has done in our life. Things that we don't wish to share with others. I have some of those. Don't ask what they are. None of your business. They're between me and the Lord. What are you waving back there? You want to know? They're private. They're between me and the Lord, and probably Maggie now. So they're hidden in this Jordan. Me and the Lord, we know where they're at. We know what they're about, and that's all that matters. They're private, and I suspect that you have some of those as well in your life, and it's a good thing. Things maybe you don't want to talk about with the world, but little things in your life that cause you to stop and look back and think about, oh, wow, God did that for me. That was a personal miracle, and it motivates my future in Him. Verse 10, for the priest bearing the ark stood in the midst of the... I just finally realized you were waving at Addie, weren't you? Okay, good. I can keep my secrets then? Okay, good. Verse 10. For the priest bearing the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord had commanded Joshua to tell the people. According to all that Moses had commanded Joshua, the people passed over in haste. And I pointed this out 2 weeks ago, that they had faith to cross, but not enough faith to drag their feet. Like, well, we believe the Lord is doing this, you know, because we see that He's doing this. I mean, the wall of water is there. But let's not test fate here. Let's hurry and get across. They're sort of like the father from Mark chapter 9. He had brought his demon-possessed child to Jesus, hoping that Jesus would cure him. And Jesus said, well, if you can have the faith, anything is possible to the one that has faith. And that man, that father, cried out, I believe. Help my unbelief. That is such a real prayer. I love that. I believe. Yes, Lord, I definitely believe. But by the way, would you help the aspects of me that don't believe? So just looking at that wall of water, I think that would definitely test your faith. Because you have to remember, it's growing by the second. The Lord cut the water off. He drew an invisible line there. He built an invisible dam there. But He didn't stop the water from flowing. Water is still coming from the north. And every second, it stacks up and gets higher and higher and bigger and bigger and backflows and overflows backward all the way to the city of Adam. We read about that last week. So I don't think anyone would want to belabor that crossing. I guess I would ask you, what kind of faith do you have? Do you have faith that crosses the river a bit fast, or do you have faith that crosses the river and you're not worried about anything, that you're willing to drag your feet? If you're the second kind of person, God bless you. You're amazing. Yeah, you're amazing. You know who was probably in the biggest hurry? The last family in the line. I would imagine they were pushing and shoving and trying to hurry the people in front of them the whole time. Or how about these folks? Because really, verse 11 tells us the last people to cross over are those bearing the ark. Verse 11, and when all the people had finished passing over, the ark of the Lord and the priest passed over before the people. Notice that terminology on the end, before the people. So the nation safely crosses. The priests are finally released to cross with the ark. And when they do cross on dry ground, they go before the people again. In other words, they head right back into that lead position. Verse 12, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh passed over armed before the people of Israel, as Moses had told them. Verse 13, about 40,000 ready for war passed over before the Lord for battle to the plains of Jericho. So Joshua here, inspired by the Lord to write, wants us to know that Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh did show up and fulfill their commitment. Kind of. Let me show you what I mean. First of all, I know by now you got to be quite familiar with the deal that Moses made with Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. We studied it in Numbers chapter 32. We have referenced it since then multiple times. So just remember that deal. The deal was that they did not want to settle in the land of promise. They didn't want to come over into Canaan. They didn't even want to cross the Jordan River. And that made Moses upset. And to appease Moses, they said, okay, Moses, we'll cross over. We'll fight with you. We'll help the rest of the nation to win its settlements in the land of promise. But once that's done, we want to come back across the Jordan and we want to settle east of the Jordan. And Moses agreed to that. So the standing deal was that they were to get little cities and homes built for their families, make sure they were all safe and taken care of. But then once that was done, those who were military eligible were to cross over, fight with the nation, and then return once the fighting was done. Well, if you go back to the second census that was taken in Numbers chapter 26, you can find the total number of military eligible men for these 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. So you're going to be taking verse 7, you're going to be taking verse 18, and you're going to be taking verse 34 from that chapter. You can total up verse 7 and verse 18, but for verse 34, you have to guesstimate, because that is the total number for the whole tribe of Manasseh, and the tribe has split. So if you want to just take a guess at this, you cut Manasseh's number in half, and then you add that to the totals of Reuben and Gad, verses 7 and 18, and that gives you approximately 111,000 men. 111,000 soldiers that weren't too old to fight, and they weren't too young to fight. They were ready to go to war. 111,000. But take a look at verse 13. How many of those 111,000 actually showed up on the east side of the Jordan? East side of the Jordan. I keep saying that the wrong way, don't I? The west side of the Jordan. The promised land. Well, it was 40,000. So only 40,000 had the privilege of crossing the Jordan River. 71,000 of them, approximately, just, you know, guesstimates here, but somewhere around 71,000 of them did not get to experience what it was like to stand there at the foot of that wall of water and watch God hold that water back miraculously. 71,000 did not get to walk across on dry ground, even though moments before this crossing, moments before this miracle, it was flooded and saturated ground. They didn't get to experience that. And then they didn't get to experience what is about to follow in our reading, and that is that when the Lord is done and everyone has crossed over, the Lord releases the water on cue. Just an absolute miracle, life-changing, future-altering stuff. And 71,000 of those men that could have experienced that did not. They missed it all. They never left the east side of the Jordan. What were they doing? Were they holding down the fort? Were they protecting the settlement there on the east side of the Jordan? Maybe. And that's honorable if so. My question would be, do you really need 71,000 men to do that? Were they just too chicken to cross? Were they just too disinterested to cross? We don't really know, but we do know that they missed out on the blessing of a lifetime. And I think we do too at times. I think we miss out on life-changing, future-altering blessings because we miss out on what the Lord is doing by staying behind when others are pressing ahead and digging in. You know, other Christians are really going for it in the Lord, pressing onward, looking for the prize, and we're missing out for whatever reason. Missing out on life-changing, future-altering stuff. It may be safer where you are. It may be easier where you are. I'm sure it is. But I can guarantee you, it won't be richer in terms of spiritual life where you are if you're staying behind while the rest of the church is pushing forward into the conquest and laying hold of the promises of God. All I can say is that if their reason truly is to avoid conflict, then, oh man, did they mess that up royally. Because conflict was going to find them. I shared with you before, Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh settling on the east of the Jordan. They were the first to be attacked. That was the first land to be conquered and taken by the enemy. So it really teaches a good lesson to us that there are battles on both sides of the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan and on the west side of the Jordan. So whether you're saved and conquesting for the promises of God or whether you're unsaved, the fact is, life is still hard and there are still battles. Yes, we battle. We fight battles as Christians, and it doesn't do you any good. It doesn't help you out at all to, you know, turn back and give your heart back to the world, taking it away from the Lord, heading back into the past. It doesn't do you any good because you're still going to fight battles, and now you don't have the Lord to help you with them. So if it's up to me, and I know that I'm going to fight anyway, I know that life's going to be tough anyway, I know that there are battles in my life that are coming anyway, if you ask me, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put on the whole armor of God, and I'm going to fight on the side where miracles are happening. I'm going to fight on the side that the Lord opened the path to through the Jordan River. I'm going to fight on the side where God's presence resides. I'm going to fight on the side where God's power is at work. Because most importantly, I'm going to fight on the side where victory has already been promised by God. And if that makes sense, then you can join me and have the same heart and the same plan in your life. Verse 14. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel. And they stood in awe of him, just as they stood in awe of Moses all the days of his life. Now, this is referring to the second generation of the nation of Israel. If this was the first generation of the nation of Israel, they would have had to spell the word awe kind of differently. Because the first generation of the nation of Israel stood in awe, A-W, of Moses. Anything that he commanded them, they said, oh, do we really? Do we gotta? Oh, Moses, we're hungry. Oh, Moses, we're thirsty. Oh, Moses, life in the wilderness is miserable. But this is the second generation of the nation of Israel. So the spelling is correct. They stood in awe of Moses. I love that. They turned out pretty well, regardless of what the first generation did, perhaps in spite of them. And now they're going to stand in awe of Joshua as they have with Moses, because as I shared with you 2 weeks ago, this really was the adding of supernatural credentials to the leadership of Joshua. He's going to always have that moving forward. The respect of the people because he didn't earn it. He didn't get it. God gave it miraculously. And we already read of the crossing of the priest. They have crossed. They have come across the Jordan completely. They are now on the side of the promised land. They have returned back to the head of the pack. We read about that, but what Joshua is going to do now is he's going to bring us back to that very moment and show us something significant in that story. So beginning at verse 15, this is what happened after the people had crossed and the priests were still out there in the Jordan riverbed waiting to be released by the Lord, by Joshua with the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 15. And the Lord said to Joshua, verse 16, command the priests bearing the Ark of the Testimony to come up out of the Jordan. Verse 17. So Joshua commanded the priests, come up out of the Jordan. Verse 18. And when the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up on dry ground, as soon as their feet cleared the flood line, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. And that sounds, you know, really prim and proper and kind of uneventful. But you just know that the truth of it is that it was an extremely violent occurrence. water just stacking up and stacking up, building up and building up, just waiting to be released by the Lord. The longer this took, the more water was backing up behind that invisible wall. And when the Lord let go of that wall, what do you think happened? That was violent. Those were torrential waters coming through there. And I would imagine it was a sight to see. Just a little bit of a glimpse of the power of God over the elements of the planet. And I think we find here just a beautiful word picture for New Testament salvation. It looks a lot like this when you come to Christ by faith and you're now living in a whole new world. You're in the promised land of God's blessings. You're now in conquest for laying hold of those blessings one by one, just as Israel would do here in the promised land. Your old life is behind you. It's on the other side of the Jordan, and it's been sealed off by the Lord. The old wilderness wandering, all the way back to the days of bondage in Egypt, all of that is behind you now. You're a new creature in Christ. Old things have passed away. All things have become new. The pathway to your past bondage, it's been washed out. It's been closed up by the Lord. Your past of wandering around aimlessly without the Lord's direction, that's now done and gone. You're in the promised land. And when the Lord closes that pathway behind you, he does it so that you won't return to it. So never build the boat that takes you back to the former things. You know, the things that at one point convinced you that you needed to be saved. The former things that were so dissatisfying, unsatisfying, unfulfilling that it brought you to Christ for something more. So remember those things, and why would you seek to figure out a way to get back to those things? You're living a new life now, and your life is aimed for a completely different destination now. Peter speaks about this in 1 Peter chapter 4, really the first four verses, but just to look at verse 2 real quick, Peter says, "As to live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God." And Paul puts it like this in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 15. "And he, Christ, died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised." So let the water of his word close that door to your sinful past forever. Don't ever try to cross that river again. And sadly, there's a group of people that's going to do just that, isn't there? Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. I mean, it's dumbfounding to me, but after the conquest is over and Israel has conquered and settled its land, they're going to come back to the Jordan River, and the Lord's not going to open the river for them to cross. Lord doesn't want them to go back to that, so they're going to have to find a human devised plan to get back across the Jordan. I hope they pick some time other than the flood season. That's all I got to say. It's a shame. Now let the Lord just wash out that old pathway back to your former life. Verse 19. "The people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month." When was the Passover? 14th day of the first month. So this is just 4 days before the Passover. Thinking they might have missed that one. If I remember reading correctly, and you along with me, we just recently read that they left their tents, they left everything on the other side. So they're kind of like starting out fresh here on the promised land side of the Jordan, and now they've got 4 days before Passover. I don't know if they had time to pull that all together. I don't know what they did, but that just happens to be their position. So technically, this is happening real close to Palm Sunday on the Christian calendar. They're crossing over right about on Palm Sunday, Christian calendar. Reading on, "And they encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho." So they're east of Jericho. They're on the west side of the Jordan River. They're in the promised land. Verse 20. "And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal." Verse 21. And he said to the people of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in times to come, what do these stones mean? Verse 22. Then you shall let your children know, Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. So now he's telling the people about this. He's informing them of the Lord's command, why he had these 12 men move these rocks the way that he has. Verse 23. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over, verse 24, so that all the peoples of the earth, and I guess that would include us, because we're reading about this. You may not have seen the monuments, but you're reading about it. And faith comes by hearing. So you're hearing it. So that all the peoples of the earth, including us, may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So just covering back to what we covered initially is that this stone memorial was first and foremost an opportunity for parents to instruct their children about the Lord and raise them in faith. But secondly, based on verses 23 and 24, and certainly it can be seen in the rest of this chapter as well, but verse 23 and verse 24 is really where it pops out to us that these monuments were also to serve the adults as a reference point for their faith, a guidepost for their faith, or if you want to call it a hitching post for their faith. It's a hitching post that you're tethered to, that also becomes a guidepost for your future. So you look back and you figure out where you're supposed to go based on what the Lord has done. It is a moment in their lives that they have built a monument to so that they can remember what the Lord had done for them. And that was to serve the purpose of helping to ground them in their trust of the Lord, in the present, in the future. It was to all be attached to this, what God had done for them in the past. Now, this is a consistent biblical approach that God takes in the Scriptures, Old Testament to New Testament, in order to assist us in our faith, in our spirituality. All throughout the Bible, you're going to see this. You're going to see God calling for ways to memorialize the great things that he has done for us in our lives. And it is not because God is especially fond of memorials or monuments. I don't think he cares much about that. It's because of the weakness of our memories that God does this. It's because in our hearts and in our minds, we so quickly forget what God has done for us, and it messes us up in our faith. You know, it's sad. It's a pathetic commentary on human flesh that God has done so much for us in the past, so much so that we should never doubt anything that we're facing in the future. And yet we get in those situations in the present, and they're going to be coming in our future too, where we get stuck. And we start to doubt, and we ask ourselves really stupid questions like, is the Lord going to be able to get me through this? That's a stupid question. I think that most of our faith problems, most of the crises of faith that we suffer through could easily be resolved if we would just take the time to stop ourselves where we are and turn around and not look at the things that we're supposed to put behind us, the sin and the failure, but if we would just stop and turn around and reflect on what God has already done in our lives, the miracles that he did for us, the miracle of conversion. You remember what your heart was like before you came to Christ for salvation. And God turned that around. What a miracle. He turned that around. He called your name. And he opened up the door of faith in your heart, and you believed, and you got saved. And what else has the Lord done for you? Maybe he's healed you of something that really could have been life-ending. Maybe he's delivered you from stuff that you were stuck on and couldn't get loose from. Well, those miracles that God did, they're reference points for our future. They're reference points for our present. They're reference points, hitching posts, guideposts, monuments for our present living that we may just stop ourselves and say, if God did that for me, that big thing back then, if God did that for me, why would he get me this far and then just stop working with me? Why would he get me this far and stop helping me? Of course, it's going to snap you back too. And you're going to say, I get it. It's so simple. The Lord didn't bring me this far to just leave me and forget about it. But everything that God has done in the past is a proof that he's working in my life. And God always finishes what he starts. Unlike Arlen, and unlike some of you, God always finishes what he starts.